every single marketer and every single brand should be attempting to earn a disproportionate share of conversation.
If you work for an organization where they say, bring us a chart that goes up and to the right, you have a challenge.
Half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. The trouble is, I don't know which half.
I am here to inspire you, to excite you, to motivate you, to transform you, to energize you.
Hello and welcome to Pipeline Visionaries. This episode features an interview with Gerardo Dada, the CMO at Catchpoint, a company that top online retailers rely on to increase their internet resilience by catching issues in the internet stack before they impact business. In this episode, Gerardo discusses his ungated content strategy and the Venn diagram of content marketing. He also shares his thoughts on sticking to your ICP and his strategy to only go after high intent marketing leads. But before we get into it, here's a brief word from our sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Qualified. If you're a revenue team that runs your business on Salesforce, Qualified will accelerate your lead generation, pipeline, and ultimately revenue. Learn more at qualified.com.
And now please enjoy this interview between Gerardo Dada, the CMO at Catchpoint, and your host, Ian Faison.
Welcome to Pipeline Visionaries. I'm Ian Faison, CEO of Caspian Studios. And today we are joined by a special guest. Gerardo, how are you?
Doing great. Thank you, Ian. Pleasure being here with you.
Excited to have you on the show. Excited to chat marketing, Catchpoint, and everything in between. Today's show is brought to you by our friends at Qualified.com. Qualified is the number one conversational sales and marketing platform for companies' revenue teams. They use Salesforce. Head over to Qualified.com to learn more. First question, Gerardo, what was your first job in marketing?
Well, I have a bit of a unique story. I became a marketer. I decided to become a marketer when I was in middle school. I read this book called Positioning, The Battle for Your Mind by Al Rice and Jack Trout. I was a kid that loved reading. And when I read that book, I said, like, you know, this book about combined psychology and strategy and business, I love this stuff. So I decided to be a marketer. So at the time, I decided to start my own business. And naturally, I focused on the marketing side. So I was an entrepreneur for the first part of my life. And then after I got married in 1998, I told my new wife that just like an actor needs to go to Hollywood, a technology marketer needs to go to the Silicon Valley or the Silicon Hills. So we moved to Austin. So that's when I got my first job officially as a marketer working for a different company.
I love that. And flash forward to today. Tell me what it means to be CMO of Catchpoint.
Well, I think today there are different types of marketing leaders. There are some that I would call more operational leaders or folks more on demand generation. There's some CMOs that just think about the marketing function. I think there's a big opportunity for marketers to become the right-hand partners for the CEO, right? A more active role in the strategy of the company. So if you look at the word marketing, we're supposed to be the experts on the market. That means we need to own the knowledge about who are buyers, who are competitors or alternatives. What are the market opportunities? What are underserved markets? How to grow? Like the job description of a marketer, in short, is growth, right? And so if you take that approach, as opposed to taking the traditional functional approach of what marketing is, which is maybe generating leads for some companies or running the website, or there are a lot of CMOs that come from a brand perspective, at least from my perspective on the technology side, a CMO means that you're the person leading the charge in terms of growth. And in terms of helping the company position itself for growth and become successful in the market. Every interaction in the market is owned by the CMO. And so I think CEOs and even, you know, boards of directors are in dire need for somebody who can bring that perspective to them and somebody they can trust with that knowledge.
Yeah, I love it. I couldn't agree more. And I think I love the definition of chief market officer. I think that, you know, I've talked about this a bunch on the show, that sort of sales job is to close the deals that are happening, whereas the marketing's job is to understand what conversations need to be happening, what the conversations need to be happening to the market broadly, to all of your different communities broadly, to the different types of communities. How are you bringing your message into that market? Is the market ready to receive that type of information, or how should they be receiving it? What platform should they be receiving on? It is a much more strategic function. I'm not saying it's more strategic than sales or more important, but it is interesting that for so often it has sort of been just like, hey, it's lead gen and that's it, when clearly that was kind of never the case.
That's true. A lot of people think still that marketing is advertising, right? And they ask about how can a company grow without marketing? Well, they can't. You can be successful without advertising, without spending money on advertising, but not without marketing. Even if it's implicit in your strategy, you have to do marketing. And as to your point, it is critically important that the marketer takes that. It's truly a more strategic perspective than sales. Doesn't mean that it's more important than sales or that the job is easier or more difficult, but marketers need to think long term, right? If you're in sales, you think about the quarter, maybe this quarter or next quarter. And that doesn't mean your job is not important or difficult. It just means that that's typically the mindset, right? You're trying to close a quarter and then you start at zero the next one. Whereas in marketing, you need to think about, well, how do I help my sales team close this quarter? And how do I position myself for the rest of the year? And where does the company need to go for the next 5 years? And what are all the elements in the market from you to a point, like communities, influencers, press, competitors, people? How do you influence all those factors in the market to give your company the best chance of being successful?
I love it. Okay, let's get to the first segment, the trust tree.
With the knowledge you've been given, you are now on the inside of what I like to call the circle of trust.
What, I thought we were in the trust tree in the nest, are we not?
This is where we go and feel honest and trusted, and you can share those deepest, darkest pipeline secrets. What does Catchpoint do?
So we are the company that the internet relies on when it needs to rely on the internet. So let me explain that. We built, the company's been around for 14 years. Our CEO used to be a practitioner at DoubleClick, later acquired by Google. And he, when he left the company, he built the tools that he wished he had when he was working at DoubleClick and later at Google. So what the company does is we have a very deep and detailed view of the internet. We use a number of different tools. Probably the most interesting one is called synthetic monitoring, which means imagine having secret shoppers, right? Like a robot basically acts like a secret shopper that is testing every part of the internet. So for example, right now it's testing my computer, connection between my computer and my router to AT&T, and all the information all the way back to, you know, Google or whatever this podcasting technology is hosted. So if you're a large company, you're relying on the internet for everything. In the past, companies used to rely on technology that was on your IT department, which was typically a closet in your building. Now everything's in the cloud, right? So I used to work in the early days of the cloud with a company called Rackspace that was kind of the pioneers of the cloud. And I used to think restaurants are probably going to be the last business to adopt the cloud. But if you think about now, without the internet, you cannot use Yelp to find the restaurant. You cannot use Google Maps to drive to the restaurant. You cannot do a QR scan to look at the menu. The app that the server uses cannot be used to enter the stuff in the menu. There's no communication back to the kitchen. There's no way to present you with a bill. There's no way to charge your credit card. So all those things in a restaurant, which is pretty much an offline, like in-person business, when you think about businesses like Amazon or Sony or, you know, e-commerce stores, they depend so much on the internet. So we are the company they rely on to make sure that every aspect of the internet they need to rely on is working, from, you know, the core of the internet, their ISPs, their cloud systems, et cetera, et cetera. It's a pretty unique technology, very different from anything else that's out there.
Yeah, and what are your customers? What are those type of companies?
It's a great question, because I find that many marketers fail to be very clear in defining their ideal customer profile. That's one of the first things we did when I joined the company with my team. So we decided we're going to focus on 6,000 companies only. We picked the top 100 of those that we want to be like our top target customers in four segments. Infrastructure means cloud infrastructure like AWS or Google or Microsoft Azure. Second, e-commerce like Walmart or Amazon. Third, SaaS companies like, I don't know, Netflix or any of those. And then fourth, financial services. And we picked those because we already had some traction in those industries and because we felt like those will be the companies that rely most on the internet, so the ones we'll see more immediately the value we bring. We're trying to follow this strategy called the bowling alley from Geoffrey Moore, which is one of the greatest students of technology marketing, where it says, like, instead of trying to go after the entire market, you pick one bowling pin, imagining a bowling alley, right? You pick one bowling pin, and when you have enough to dominate that market, then you look for the next two adjacent bowling pins. So that's what we did. We started with infrastructure. Today, for example, most marketers are familiar with the CDNs. Every CDN out there uses Catchpoint to monitor their performance and even to show their performance to their customers. So now after that, we're going after the next three pins behind that. And the second part is that not only defining your ICP, but also having the discipline of being truth to that definition, meaning from a sales perspective, of course, we will be opportunistic and take some other opportunities. But in terms of the ICP today, that definition of who are our target customers defines our marketing strategy, what media do we go after, what events we attend, et cetera, because it's easy just comparing the attendance or the audience of a particular channel with the ICP definition or those 6,000 companies that we're going after.
I love it, Gerardo, music to my ears, because, you know, like when we sit down with a customer at Caspi and we talk about like, hey, well, let's make a podcast or a video series or something like that. That's the first question. Okay, what's your ICP? Tell us a little bit more about the ICP. Dig in there. What's the number of accounts that you care about? Okay, what are the top 100 accounts? Literally, I would say that exact thing every single time. So funny because so few people that you comparatively can answer all those questions. It's remarkable to me.
it's such a basic marketing question, right? Such a basic question. And it's not only about ICP in terms of the company itself. It's also about who are your buyers? Who are our target personas, right? It's also very important to understand not only who are those personas, but what are their titles, what are they, how they think. Because, you know, nowadays, especially in B2B, you're selling to committees, right? Like it's not one buyer, it's multiple buyers. And each buyer has different filters or different criteria in how they're going to evaluate your company. And even if you don't have that empathy, that truly the understanding of their emotional side, then you have less chance of being successful. Because at the end of the day, I believe that people buy emotionally and then they justify their decisions rationally. I've seen that in my career for, you know, a $6 coffee cup all the way to companies making billion-dollar investments.
100%. I mean, it's sacrilege to even think that it's not that way. You know, like you're exactly right. And you're going to like our next question because it is about the buying committee. And it's part of the reason why we structured the beginning of the show exactly how we structure this is because if I don't understand, you know, what your company does, who you're selling to, what are the personas within that, how you structure your team, then asking you how you spend your money doesn't matter at all. Because who cares if Gerardo is targeting, you know, SMBs, I don't care how he spends his money. It doesn't matter to me how he spends his money if he's targeting SMBs, right, if I'm selling enterprise and vice versa.
Exactly. 100%.
Anywho. What's your buying committee look like? What do those personas look like?
So it's also a great debate that we've had internally, or I think many marketers struggle with, right? Because it's easy to try to go to the C-level decision maker, right? Everybody in technology is selling to the CIO or to the CISO. I used to be in cybersecurity in my previous job. Mm-hmm. And when people said, let's go after the CISO, he's ultimately the biggest decision maker. So like, yeah, but there's another 8,000 cybersecurity companies going after that same person. So the chances of you talking to that person are going to be fairly minimal. And you need to make sure that your problems that you're solving are relevant to that buyer. On the other side, you don't want to be going too tactical, right? Because unless your product leads itself to be sold tactically on a PLG, product-led growth basis. We've recently implemented this sales methodology called command of the message. And one of the principles is you get delegated to the person you sound like. And that's why it's so important to understand your target buyer. So in our case, we're targeting either the VP of IT or the VP of observability. But at the end of the day, what we're looking for is not necessarily who do we want to sell, but who's really going to become our champion, right? And I use champion in a very deliberate way. I encourage all my marketing peers to read The Champion Sale from Richard Rivera. Mm-hmm. He obviously is somebody who trains sales teams and advises sales teams, but understanding what's really that concept of a champion means it's somebody who's going to be your advocate and who has access to the economic buyer. So it's not the economic buyer. It's somebody who's going to have a vested interest in solving a problem where they will be willing to partner with you to bring that technology into the company. And he's going to be the champion, meaning working with procurement and working with security and letting you about challenges and roadblocks and basically working one-on-one with your company to make sure that this is a joint project, that it becomes successful.
I love that. It's such good advice. Great book recommendation as well. And I think that another thing that you don't hear a lot of is sort of that idea of who is your champion and what are they seeking? You know, what is the thing? And like, if it's, I've always say this, but it's sometimes that thing is getting promoted. Sometimes that thing is like going from senior director to VP is a huge step for anyone to get to that level, right? So it's like, if you're the best company in the world at helping, you know, IT senior directors get promoted to VP, that's a valuable position to be, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you also need to think, what would we need to do as a company for that senior director to help them get promoted, right?
Right.
And it's super satisfying. We just had somebody in Germany, a big company that a lot of people recognize, our champion got promoted. And he said, like, I got promoted thanks to the work I did with you guys. And that's very fulfilling, right, professionally and at a personal level as well.
I love that. How do you structure your marketing team?
Well, I think my team is fairly standard in terms of I have a small group that is customer marketing. Anytime you're selling SaaS, which is most software, you're going to need a customer marketing team. I have a demand generation team that includes also our content and operations. And content means not necessarily the creation of content, but the publication. So meaning website and all the creation of assets, graphic design, et cetera, that support demand generation. And then I have a product marketing team that owns competitive intelligence, and it's aligned based on the skill set of that team, based on different types of solutions that we sell. I come from a product marketing background myself, and I think it's really important that as a company, you need to decide if it makes sense to do audience marketing, product marketing, or solutions marketing. And depending on how you sell and what your portfolio looks like, and sometimes a combination might be the right one. And last, I also recently, as of probably 6 months ago, inherited acquisition sales as well. So now as a marketer, I own everything from the creating awareness from PR, demand gen, SDR, all the way to closing deals. And then a separate team owns the expansion, right? So it's full accountability. There's no finger pointing at all to anybody else except for to myself.
Love that. And then final question for our trust tree here. What's your marketing strategy?
We obviously with a targeted list of customers like we do, we follow an ABM strategy, right? So rather than fishing for customers with a net, we're fishing with a spear gun. We are very deliberate about the companies we want to go after. And we do two things that I think are fairly unique or maybe unconventional. To me, make their common sense. The first thing we did is when I joined the company, is we ungated all our content. Being a relatively small company, awareness and brand are critically important for us, right? The first thing we want to be considered. So when a company needs to solve a problem, like the type of problems that we solve, we want to be one of the first companies they think about. And so if we put our content behind a wall gate, then that's friction against that, right? I've done this in the past in my career. So what I did when I joined the company, I actually ran myself a campaign on LinkedIn. I went very detailed on who was the ideal customer, and I built a campaign offering a free Gartner paper, a white paper. So it's third party, very high reputation, very valuable. And I measured not only the click rate to the page, but also the completion of the form. And what was really surprising is typically for every 100 people that visit a page, one person will complete the form. And in my experiment with my audience in this at Catchpoint, it was 400-1, meaning for us, if we wanted to pursue a gated content strategy, we would be giving up the opportunity to influence 399 customers for every one customer we had the opportunity to influence. And that for what? So that we can have a group of SDRs calling people that just wanted to download a white paper and try to sell them, right? Like they didn't have any really interest. So we changed that completely and said, like, look, we're going to focus our content strategy not on producing volumes of content, but on producing a small number of highly valuable, relevant pieces of technical and educational content that we're going to set free and we're going to make available to anybody out there. Like, for example, we built a piece with a company like Walmart and other large retailers about how to optimize your CDN, right? And we made it a very high-value educational piece of content where it doesn't even mention our company until the last page, right? So it's really about helping the end user and building that trust that we know the stuff we're talking about. And so we set that content free, and we point at the end of the document back to our website where they can find more resources. The second resource in that chain of content that a prospect might be interested in, it still is educational and technical and valuable, but it starts introducing our company and how we can help solve some of those problems. And then we start making content that makes the opportunity to engage with our company a little bit more evident, like request a demo, ask for pricing, or ask a technical question. And so our sales team does not engage with leads. We don't do lead scoring. We go to a trade show and we don't scan people at random. Like I used to go with previous companies, there was a contest of who can scan the most people, right? And you had your scanning gun and you were trying to scan even the service people or students or whomever, right? So now, you know, I was in London recently at a trade show and somebody said, hey, can I get one of your tchotchkes? I forgot t-shirt or something we're giving away. And so like, sure, mm-hmm. Here you go. And the person naturally says, hey, do you want to scan my badge? It's like, no. And the person was confused, like, what do you mean? He's like, you don't even know what we do. Why would I scan you? Do you want to have 5 emails and 5 calls from our SDR? I says, no. And for me, why would I have my SDR team calling you if you have zero interest in our products and technology, right? So it's a complete waste of time on both sides. So complete we waste. Came up with this concept of, look, we're only going to focus on what we call high intent marketing qualified leads. Yeah. But what I mean by high intent is one, they're a member of the ICP, right? So both company and title. So the company is part of our target list and the title is one of the personas we want to talk to. Second, that person has done some level of research, meaning that person has read white papers, read videos, been to our website multiple times. And three, that person is actually asking us for something, right? So that's the intent. I have an intent to evaluate your product, not intent as many of the ABM vendors will let you believe, right? Like they read up an article that is loosely related with your company. So, hey, you have an intent lead. In this case is we know this person has interacted multiple times and they're explicitly asking for something as the next logical step in their evaluation criteria. And the consequence of that is one, our prospects love the idea of being able to explore on their own without marketing or salespeople trying to nudge them and force them to do things that are not natural or at their own pace. But the other side that's very powerful is that our sales team, even the SDRs, instead of having to call 700 leads from a trade show, they focus on the 25 people that spent 30 minutes with us, with whom we had a very specific conversation. We validated they have a problem we can help them with. And they asked us, hey, can you help us set up a meeting? Can I talk to your technical guys? Do you know, technical questions, et cetera. So our sales team then can do a lot more research about that company, about their needs, about their strategy and how we can help them and have more meaningful, valuable conversations with those customers. And that's very different from companies like, you know, $1,000 bribe to accept the meeting, right? I get those totally. Emails like, hey, we'll give you a free Columbia jacket if you spend 20 minutes with my sales guy. And it's like, you know, I could donate the jacket to a shelter or something, but it's a waste of time for both sides. Like my time is more valuable than that. And I feel bad taking your jacket and your time. I'm really not interested. So you're really to a point bribing customers to take unnatural actions when they're not really neither leads nor qualified, nor they have intent. So it's a little bit of gaming the system as a marketer.
So I love everything that you said, Gerardo. So I'm 100% in agreement with everything you said. The final piece about sort of like bribing people, I think that that's a really successful strategy for some folks, and I've seen it work really well. But I think that the execution, it's all about execution, right? Where it's like,
sure,
if you're buying a sales conversation that you said is high intent, then 100% it's worth the $100. It's like if you're buying a conversation to give someone, you know, $100, like that doesn't make you anything. What I love that type of play for is like the, hey, try us again for the first time messaging, where it's like, hey, you used to be a customer and you guys have been away from us for a handful of years. Products totally changed. Stuff is new. Like, do you want to come back and just, you know, we can have a conversation, we'll give you, you know, the free thing. If not, no worries at all. And then at least you can have a conversation that's a little bit more productive to say, hey, you know, we quit because you didn't have, you know, whatever. It's like, oh, well, wouldn't you know that's a feature that we have now, you know, or whatever it is. But at least, you know, some type of, you know, reference point. So anywho,
let me make a comment to that, because you made a really good point that there are some products in some instances where that might be the right strategy. If your market is very broad and your product has a very low barrier to trying it and it's highly sticky, then it might be worth it, right? Like there are companies, like there's a company called No Relic in our space that for years mm-hmm. they offer a free t-shirt for creating an account. But they knew that by creating an account, a lot of developers will try it out, and they knew that a high percentage of those people who try it out will end up liking the product and subscribing, even if it's a free account. But they didn't. What's important about doing that is that you're not creating the illusion that that's a lead. You know exactly what are the chances of that person being in your target customer and what are the conversion rates you expect from there to become an actual customer. I've also been in a marketing team that I should remain unnamed, very similar strategy. We needed more downloads or PQLs in that case. And so we created a ton of very cool t-shirts and we artificially inflated what appeared like demand, but it was not real demand, to the extent that, you know, we're selling to IT, so our IT departments like the shirts so much, they created dummy email accounts so they could get more shirts. And so literally there was cake at the end of the month to celebrate the high number of leads, and the sales team missed their number because they had a high number of people that had zero interest in buying, right? So if you're going to do that, it's worth doing as long as it's strategic, you know the conversion rates, and you have maybe an interesting step in place to indicate who from all these people that we bribed are the ones who are really interested, that we think we can convert to customers, and then doing the math to make sure that that makes sense from a business perspective.
Gosh, couldn't agree more. You know, they say the best podcasts have a little bit of a dissent, but I sure can't find it with you so far. Let's get to our next segment, the playbook.
This is what's great about sports. This is what the greatest thing about sports is. You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game.
Where you open up your playbook and talk about the tactics that help you win. What are your three channels or tactics that are your uncuttable budget items?
Well, so anybody who is going after an ABM strategy, my three tactics would be content. Second would be, I call it loosely, intent, which is basically, I would not even call it intent. I say like people who have a little bit of a signal that they might have some loose interest in the topic. And the mm-hmm. third one, targeted marketing, which can be done through LinkedIn or something like that, right? So those would be like, those are the three tools foundational. In the side of content, I already mentioned it's ungated and all that. I believe that the best content marketing strategy, especially if you are in a position where you're trying to educate the market, you're trying to establish thought leadership, is finding that space in the center of three concentric circles. One is what your audience cares about. Mm-hmm. The other one is what you know more than anybody else. And the third one is what the technology or the point of use that will predispose your prospects to buy, right? Or increase the likelihood of them to buy.
I love that. That's really great. I spent my formative years in the Army. And so I was talking about sort of fight where you can win. And that second chunk that you talked about there about, you know, the stuff that sort of like essentially you have a unique piece on, I think is so important because so often, you know, when I say fight where you can win, it means what can only Caspian teach you, right? Caspian Studios can teach you something that nobody else can teach you on this earth, whether it's we have some proprietary data that we did, we have a study that we did, we have some insights from our customers, or, you know, something that is uniquely us that someone couldn't really copy, or, you know, or they could, but it just wouldn't feel the same. And if you have that, or you should have that, and if you don't, you need to figure it out. And if you're creating content with that in mind, well, boy, nobody's content is going to be like yours. Because your content is wholly unique. And I think that just so often people don't want to do that.
You're right, because especially now where a lot of content teams are driven by SEO optimization, right? So they will look for the hot keywords and they will outsource content production. And now with generative AI, it's so tempting to create a content farm that can spit out tons of content, pretty bad content, impersonal, pretty vanilla. But, you know, if you all you care about is publishing 10 articles per day, you can get it done fairly quickly. My take is it's more valuable to create one authentic, valuable, unique piece of content that is going to be closely tied to what makes you unique. So the way we plan our content is like I told my team is like, I don't care about a blog post every Tuesday. I don't care about a LinkedIn post in the morning, one in the afternoon. Throw away the calendar. We'll post whenever we have something useful to say. That's the only rule. If a week goes by and we have nothing useful to say, that's fine. The worst thing we want to do is have, like, I don't know, hire a writer somewhere to write an article about, I don't know, recipes or something that is irrelevant. And people then get trained to think, like, when Cashpoint publishes, it's going to be useless. We want to create the opposite, where every time we post something on LinkedIn or on our blog, we want people to say, like, I want to read that article. Because it's so easy to just keep scrolling, right? The scrolling is endless in all social platforms, LinkedIn and Instagram, wherever you are. So if your content doesn't hook people in the first 2 seconds, you're gone forever. It's useless. It's better to say, like, oh, I know these guys have something useful to say, so I'm going to stop and I'm going to read this. And if it's not relevant to me, at least I read the first 10, 15 seconds and I can move on. But you have a higher chance of having a true audience where you have an ability to influence the market versus just a publishing machine.
I totally agree. I talk about all the time, throw away the content calendar. It's completely useless. The reason why content calendars matter is because it helps us organize our thought leadership, not helps the customer organize how they want to think about buying the product or learning about the space or getting a new job or getting a promotion or whatever. Like, you need to optimize your, you know, those things for them and like what they want to learn about, not just like how you want to create content. And, you know, one of the examples, you know, building a series for someone is kind of like, you know, it's a very intimate thing because it kind of, you see how they're marketing. And one of the things that we always talk about is like, well, these are our themes for the year. And you say, well, is this what your customers care about? Are they, you know, well, we want to make sure we talk about this and that and this. It's like, yeah, I hear what you're saying. But like at the same time, it's like, what is most interesting to the audience is this, this, and this. Like, shouldn't that be, you know, the thematic elements? And to the final point there, obviously, I love content, so I could talk about this forever. But I think so often people are trying to think about what to write instead of how to deliver it in the best way. Does it need to be delivered in a 30-second video? Does it need to be delivered in audio format? Does it need to be delivered in a short newsletter? Does it need to be delivered in a long form, you know, thing? Does it need to be delivered picturally? Does it need to have no words at all? And those are the sort of things that you start thinking about instead of what to write, how to deliver it, and how, what is the utility of the consumption of it? Oh, this person's going to be walking their dog. What should I be delivering them? You know, like it just changes how you think about things. And then you don't think about, hey, what could I throw into ChatGPT? You think about like, how could I deliver something that's exceptional to them that they could get all the information they need about, you know, whatever, containerized, whatever in, you know, 5 minutes a week or whatever.
I completely agree with you. So one of the things we do around that is that we have five or six different key points of view. And those points of views are fairly extensive, right? So it's not just say something, you're done. It's a story, and it's a way of thinking, and it's elaborate. So we're constantly thinking about what is the right hook to get people to start reading about this? What are the right blog posts to get people in that journey to learn about this? What are those white papers or videos? What is the right format to tell the story? How can we improve our storytelling about this point of view? What are the new customer stories that we can add that illustrate the point of view? And just keep improving in those points of view, as opposed to this mentality that's just like, let's just produce more and more and more, right? And so it's better to continue to focus and refine, invest money and time and resources to refine your key content assets and make them better all the time than trying to produce new content assets all the time. Especially when you have a B2B sales team, you typically end up with a sales library that has hundreds and hundreds of documents that nobody has the time to even categorize or read, much less your customers.
Okay, so that is your number one uncuttable budget item, is content.
Correct, because in our case, we are trying to create a category, and we have a fairly unique point of view. We're trying to educate people on, like I used in the example of the restaurant, the importance of the internet, how things have changed and everything's internet dependent, right? How after the pandemic, the majority of workers were remote, working from home, working from a hotel, and you need to be productive to do your job. And what's interesting is that market research shows that about 45% of remote users experience significant digital friction on a daily basis. In our case, because we're educating customers on why they need to think about this new category of solutions, we need to prioritize education. That's different from selling a category like, I don't know, if you were selling antivirus or CRM, companies know that they need those technologies. The only question is, which one should I buy, right? Then there might still be an element of education on maybe the value of having a broader platform that does more than CRM or you know, the latest antivirus technologies and detection systems, et cetera. But the more that you are trying to get people to think differently, the more important thought leadership and content becomes.
100% agree. What are your other uncuttable budget items?
Well, the second one I mentioned is targeted marketing, paid advertising through tools like LinkedIn, right? Where you can set up either a list of companies, a group of industries, company sizes, a set of titles, and then target very specific people and show them those hooks that you think are going to get them to engage with you, with your company, right? What I see in the market with my colleagues in marketing is that they typically have like a product marketing team that's really smart about the market and customers. And then they have the demand gen team that does their own thing and tries to optimize, but they are oftentimes forced to create their own content and make guesses. And it's a huge opportunity to have those teams working together and develop, continuously build kind of this culture of experimentation and education internally to try new things, try new angles, try different hooks or try different phrases.
Yeah, seriously. What about something that's maybe not working or fading away or something you're not going to be investing in?
Well, we, like many companies, we went big into social, right? And we had a Facebook account and we had an Instagram account and so on. At this point, we're not investing in those channels anymore. I think the challenge is that there's twofold. One, marketing, as we were saying, is becoming more and more complex. There are more ways to interact with the market, more tools, more places where you need to be, more things to be paying attention to. The work of a marketer is never done, right? It's not like sales where you close your quarter or, I don't know, if you're in support, you close all your incidents and you go home and you have nothing else to do. In marketing, there's always more research, more you can learn from customers, more places where you could, you know, put your finger, more places where you can interact with the market. So that's on one side. And then on the other side, there's always new technologies and new shiny objects that distract us, right? Remember location-based marketing and Facebook commerce and augmented reality and all those things that were going to be the future of marketing, right? Remember, we were supposed to be in the post-email era, or the post-PC era as well, right?
Yep.
And the reality is that marketing has not changed that much. Yeah, there's some things that have evolved, of course, like, you know, we've talked about ABM and some other things, but the foundational things don't. And while there's, it's really important to experiment and to think through the validity of those technologies and tools, it's important to recognize they're tools to meet one objective, which is growth.
How do you think about experiments and investing those little, you know, hey, we're going to try this, we're going to try that, we're going to put, you know, 5% of our budget into this?
I think it's mandatory. I think you need to spend maybe 5% or maybe less, depending on how big your budget is, in experiments. And experiments could be new channels, new messages, new ways of thinking. But the critical part about experiments is being very clear from the beginning what is going to be the measure of success, right? So, And the measure of success cannot be like likes, or cannot be a what I call a vanity metric, right? Mm-hmm. Like how many people clicked on something. We used to have, at one of the companies I work for, we had a video that was very funny. It was super successful in terms of views. People loved it, but nobody was interested in buying anything. It's almost like the Super Bowl ads, right? Like Super Bowl ads are optimized for entertainment, not for influence. And I think that might be because, you know, advertising agencies make money on creativity awards, not on sales. Maybe they should change the compensation.
Really quick on that, I just want to jump in and say that. So it's funny, like, you know, our company's won a handful of different awards and things like that. And, you know, it's awesome when you get awarded. And I think it's more of a team thing. But I heard a marketer say this one time that they're like, I want our team to win awards because I want our team to be award winning. And I want people to see their impact on the marketing org, that like thinking creatively and doing things like that can win awards. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is like, are we driving pipeline? How are we supporting sales? How are we like influencing the market? You know, those sort of things. That awards are like, you know, there's something else. They're this thing that can drive us to do and to create and to like tap into that part of our brain. And like when we put like our Caspian stuff out there, I'm like, I don't mention that we have all these awards. Like, who cares? Who cares if we got a Webby or not? Like, nobody cares. It's cool. But
yep. And you know, as an example, I was working with one of the leading consumer electronic companies, and they were talking about their social media strategy. And the guy who was like the director of social media said, like, our goal this year, and this is back in the day, I'm thinking 2009, our goal is to get to 1 million followers. And asked them, and then what? It's like, and he was like, what do you mean then what? Yeah, is that your goal? But then once you get 1 million followers, how are you going to use them? It's like, I don't know. But then what's next? Said maybe 2 million followers? Yeah, so I think marketers are going to be more strategic to the business. As we were talking about the role of the CMO, the more they think about the true scoreboard for the business, right? In our case, my team in marketing, the demand-gen part of marketing, the only scoreboard is revenue and growth. That's it. There's nothing else matters. So if we say, hey, we have a bunch of leads and MQLs and we went to a trade show and, I don't know, our article was picked up by this publication or whatever, it's completely irrelevant if it doesn't ring the cash register. And so back to your question, experiments need to be measured in terms of actual revenue. So you need to have the instrumentation, maybe not to know, but at least to have a good indicators that what you're doing is moving the needle. And the reason why I say not to know is because the whole attribution thing is, I think, one of the things that needs to go out. My team is prohibited to say marketing sourced leads. And also, there's no such thing as sales source leads. Because there's not one person who can buy from us without talking to sales and without going to our website. So everything is influencing us, right? Goes back to the idea that people buy emotionally. And so we recognize that people buy emotionally, and that even if you ask people, why did you make that decision, you cannot really even acknowledge the true reason for your decision-making as a human. And then third, that about 70% of the purchase process is what people call the dark funnel, right? So companies don't have visibility into that. Trying to make scientific decisions based on how a customer moves through the funnel is absurd, to be honest, right? Because we don't see any of that. You're just making guesses, and if you rely on that bad data, then your your conclusions are likely going to be incorrect. A good example, we did a study. I used to work at SolarWinds, and and they said, like, should we continue investing in trade shows? And they said, well, if we look at our attribution data, the answer is no, because, you know, there's no direct attribution from a lead we got at a trade show to somebody actually buying. Like, that efficiency was very, very low. So if I just look at that data, the answer would be absolutely no. Let's kill those trade shows. Never do a trade show ever again. However, if I interview customers and ask them, where did you first learn about our company? The most common answer was trade shows, right? And this was person to person, right? 100% different answer, right? So if you look at the qualitative scientific answer, the answer is no. If you look at the qualitative human response, the answer is yes, we need to do more of those.
I'm extremely data-driven. I think we all should be. But data-driven does not mean you just follow the numbers. Like, that's the whole point, is like, data-driven is not about following the numbers. It is like about test, iterate, look at numbers, try to understand why the things are happening. What are the reasons why those things are happening? If you want to sit there and tell me, hey, what we realized with trade shows is that the T&E budget for our trade shows was so much money, we are not ROI positive on trade shows. Okay, that's an interesting thing to say, that like, hey, that might not be the case. It's incredibly complex. And I think it's reductive to just say, oh, the data shows blank. It's like, does it really?
And you're so right about that. In fact, I have a blog that's called The Adaptive Marketer. I wrote a blog post, I think it's now 10 years, 14 years ago, called The Mirage of Data. And I built this when big data was a big thing, one of those big trends, both IT and marketing. And it just, my writing was about this illusion that if we only had more data, we'll have the answer. But, well, you know, I'm not suggesting that anybody should just do decisions based on their gut. But at the same time, the assumption that the answer is always in the data assumes that, one, you're capturing the right data, that your data is correct, and your data is forward-looking, where in reality, oftentimes, is the opposite. The problem is not that they have too little data. They have too much data. They don't know what to do with it. And now with AI, the risk is even bigger, right? They will ask these AI engines to analyze data and come to conclusions and take those conclusions as truth, where if the data that they're acting upon is incomplete or inaccurate or misleading, the conclusions are going to be equally incorrect.
We deal with this a lot with podcast stuff because people will like start a podcast series. So first of all, they're like, what's the podcast strategy? I'm like, there's no such thing as a podcast strategy. What is your content strategy? AKA, what is your marketing strategy? Like, marketing is content. Every single thing in marketing is content. Like, there's no thing in marketing that you do that does not have content. Someone wrote the copy or created the stuff. So there's content somewhere, first off. Second off, this is just saying, what is the audio focused portion of it, or video focused portion, or whatever? And then, like, how do you build a series? You're like, oh, well, we did a podcast, you know, 3 years ago. It didn't work. Like, oh, let me go look at it. It's like, oh, you did 5 episodes where you're some person on your team interviewed random people and you published them over the course of the year. Like,
yeah, you're confusing the execution with the viability of a channel or a tactic.
Yeah. If you said, hey, we're going to do some SEO stuff, and you wrote 3 blog posts, and you're like, SEO doesn't work. Like, that's the equivalent of what people are doing, like, constantly.
That's
like,
very true.
Well, yeah, you just did a really bad job at making a podcast. Right? Like,
100%
that's
agree.
Just what you did. So anyways, like, and then, so then people will dismiss a channel, and the same thing with events, or the same thing with newsletters or email or whatever. The one thing that I will say, though, is the thing that drives me crazy. I'm blanking on the term. When the planes come back that are full of bullet holes, and then they're like, oh, these planes got shot up in the wings. We must be getting hit on the wings. So they up armor all of the wings. But in reality, all the planes that didn't come back, survivor's bias. Yeah, they do this survivor's bias where it's like, hey, well, we source all these deals from outbound. It's like, yeah, but you're getting a 1% response rate. You're pissing off 99% of people.
And it's funny you bring that, because that's actually going back to your question about the 3 non-negotiables. That's why I like to invest. My third one would be in an ABM tool that is intent-based, because that gives me a little bit of visibility in another way of saying this in a more visual way is the dark side of the moon, right? You only see one side of the moon all the time, which is the type of the side of the market that you always interact with. The customers that see you at trade shows and the ones that see you on LinkedIn. What about customers that don't go to trade shows and are not on LinkedIn? You're missing out on that dark side of the moon. So you need to think holistically about the market and make sure that you take their voices into account from an overall market perspective.
Final segment here, quick hits. These are quick questions and quick answers, just like how Qualified helps companies generate pipeline quickly. Go to qualified.com to learn more. Qualified is the best tool in your entire toolkit. Go to qualified.com to learn more. If you use Salesforce, that is. If you don't, then don't worry about it. Harder, are you ready?
Yeah, ready.
What's a hidden talent or skill that's not on your resume?
Curiosity is the main one. I'm just a naturally curious person. I've listened to 400 audiobooks so far, and that's on top of paper books and, you know, ebooks and a bunch of other stuff. So I think that curiosity, which manifests itself in learning and reading, is extremely powerful.
What is a favorite book, podcast, or TV show that you'd recommend?
I've read every marketing and strategy and business book that I can get my hands on. I have three that I recommend to every marketer. The first one, obviously, is Positioning the Battle for Your Mind, because it's the book that helped me find my calling. Mm-hmm. And it's a great book. Those authors, Al Rice and Jack Trout, they're phenomenal. And all their books are pretty good. The second one is Predictably Irrational. So one of the things that fascinates me about marketing is that psychological side. So Dan Ariely is one of the leading behavioral economists, and the experiments that he talks about and the irrationality of how people make decisions, I think, is fundamental for marketers to understand, but also understanding that it's predictable, meaning even though it's irrational, we behave the same way all the time, just as irrational all the time. And the third one is Made to Stick. That's another book by the Heath brothers that teaches marketers to speak with clarity.
I love it. If you weren't in marketing or business at all, what do you think you'd be doing?
Part of me thinks I would be a photographer, right? I don't know if that's kind of like a dream job for most people. For me, growing up, I love reading National Geographic. I love photography. I had my own dark room when I was like 12 years old. Wow. And so for me, the idea of traveling around the world, taking pictures, and it's fascinating. Just capturing the natural beauty of the world we live in is just incredible.
What's your best advice for a first-time CMO?
My best advice for a first-time CMO is to learn to think like a business person. Don't think like a marketer. I think it's good advice for every person in business to think like your boss, right? So if you're a CMO, you need to think like the CEO. In fact, you'll be better if you learn to think like the board. And it sounds easy, but it's really difficult. It requires changing your mindset, right? It's like marketing. You need to understand that's your audience, right? What do they care about? What is the language they care about? Do they care about leads? No. They care about marketing? No. They only care about growth, right? And profitability and other metrics. So if you're trying to find ways to learn how to think like your CEO, I encourage you to read some of the financial statements for publicly traded companies. Read their quarterly reports, their investor presentations, listen to their investor calls, subscribe to business magazines. Ask your CEO, what do you read? What podcasts or books or you know, websites or Business Week, whatever that is. And the more you think like the business, the more you can become that right-hand person for the business. And the more they can become, instead of an operational advertising or brand CMO, you can become the CMO that is the engine for growth for the company and the CMO that is the primary interface to the market and knows more about the market than anybody else.
Gerardo, it has been wonderful having you on the show. Again, I could talk to you for hours. For our listeners, you can go to catchpoint.com, check them out. This SRE report 2024 is out. You can download your copy. All sorts of cool stuff. Give an elbow to your VP of IT and tell them to check out Catchpoint if you're in a global 5,000 company. Gerardo, any final thoughts? Anything to plug?
To plug, well, I enjoy writing on my blog. I haven't done that in a while, but I have a lot of old content or good content that I'm making a promise to keep it updated. Theadaptivemarketer.com.
Yeah, some really good stuff on theadaptivemarketer.com. I was gonna promote that and I forgot. Great article. I like the one at the top on marketing according to Seth Godin. There's a bunch of other great stuff in there, some old interviews and things. So check that out as well.
Great. Thank you for reading that. Yeah. Hope you find it useful.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you again. Take care.
It's a pleasure, Ian.
Thanks again to our friends at Qualified.com, a conversational sales and marketing platform that transforms the way B2B companies sell. Go to Qualified.com to learn more.